We want empathy. We want metrics. And we want recognition that this is, we need everyone to be on the same page, that this is a partnership. And this is a partnership that's going to go on for a while. So that means if you disagree on something, cool. That's good. Bring it up. Talk it out. Show why something doesn't work and make it both ways, which means getting a little bit out of the comfort zones, right? For a front-end engineer, that means understanding a little bit better why a certain UX is better. And for a UX designer, that's like why something is technically infeasible. It's a partnership.
Hello, everyone. In this episode, I'm talking to Dechen Chen, who is a senior front-end engineer at Amazon. I apologize in advance for the audio quality. My microphone got messed up, so it's kind of a bit lousy. But the conversation itself is super interesting. Dechen shares his career and entrepreneurial journey and some insights from the enterprise world of user experience. And we also talk about computer literacy in different generations, and something that I wasn't really thinking about, but was an interesting surprise. Surprising insight. Also, we discussed the potential and the problems of the current AI tools and how designers should be collaborating with engineers. In addition, we talk about the mirror exposure effect, building trust with and without data, and much more. Enjoy.
Well, hello, Dechen. Hello, how are you?
I'm good, Karel. How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. Welcome to my show, and thanks for being willing to come in and share your perspective as a essential partner working with designers. So you've got a lot of experience working with us as designers. So I'm sure you have a lot of do's and don'ts of what a great designer should do.
Oh, thank you for having me, Karel. And I'll try my best to answer those questions.
Excellent. Okay, so let's start with your story, because your story is quite interesting. You have a combination of engineering and development, and also you. It looks like that you are very passionate with UX as a I guess activity, or at least mindset or life philosophy. I don't know. And also you have an interesting track of the independent, like entrepreneurial adventures. So let's start from the beginning. Why did you get into engineering, and where it led you, and what do you do today?
Sure. I've always had a passion for visual arts ever since I was little. But it was my university professor, Edward Lenk, who inspired me to learn more about user experience. So as you mentioned, since then, I've had the privilege to wear many hats in the human-computer interactions space, including being a UX designer for brief periods of time in my last 13 years. I am constantly amazed by the amount of problem solving and creativity that goes into the UX space. But my heart rests as a engineer. I love problem solving above all else. I love building solutions, and I love building the actual products themselves. Like, nothing gets me more excited than demoing something that myself or team I work closely with created. That just gives me such an adrenaline rush. And whether the outputs of that demo is feedback or criticism or just kudos, I accept them all. I love the process. So I've been in this industry, in the tech industry, for 13 years, and I am not bored of being a front-end engineer. So yeah, that's my story of where I am today, I guess.
Interesting how you it's almost like you're that one of those unicorns, especially that you also kind of designed interfaces and you also can code them yourself. So it's almost like you can do and work on your own projects from start to finish. And I would like actually to learn more about your entrepreneurial endeavors, and it looks like that you have a bunch of projects that you worked on. It looks like you're also very passionate in the gaming industry, and some of the side projects, they're related to solving some problems for gamers, right, and low game developers. So maybe you can elaborate a bit more on that path of your career or passions.
Sure. I've loved games forever, whether it's board games or computer games. Now, of course, I'm going to be more biased towards computer games because it's the field that I am in. But with games, it's a very interesting way of thinking about UI compared to your typical enterprise applications. And it is that degree of freedom that I really love with the gaming industry, right? So when you build a UI in a game, you're building a layer that sits in front of the world in which the user is an agent, or the player, sorry, in this case, the player is an agent in this world, and you're providing them information, right? And it's almost like, well, what can you give without taking away immersion from the game? Or what information, how do you convey information in a way that is minimal and context aware and gives your players the tools they need and the information they need to make the right decisions in the game? So we can think of the game UI as a separate but equally important companion to the game experience itself. And I know that in more recent years, the two worlds have been becoming a little bit more meshed together. I was especially impressed. My daughter was showing me Minecraft, and it's like, well, like in Minecraft, you actually hold the map in your hands, and it's like, here's a map. It's an object in the game. Now, the map has a bit of a UI to it, but it was different from a lot of other games where your map is, you know, separate layer. So I can see the world kind of blurring a little bit between in-game UI and UI as the game. This world and the design around it fascinates me. I've been doing a lot of reading and thinking about how to bridge that, how to give players and users the tools they need to make the right decisions, which is, I think, the ultimate purpose of UX design.
Mm-hmm. So because you're not in game UI design mm-hmm. today, so you're more like in the enterprise world, right? So mm-hmm. would you rather, is your goal to move back to this kind of more passionate area of yours, or you're also as passionate in the enterprise world?
Oh, I am equally passionate in both worlds.
They look so different, though. yeah, maybe you can elaborate. What do you find appealing in the enterprise world?
Sure. In the enterprise world, of course, there is no game. There's no your users are not agents inside a world.
Yet.
But what I love about it is that it's a bit more abstract. They're still agents. They're still agents who are there to, in our case, manipulate data, look up information, and make decisions that have real-world impact. They're agents in the real world, and we're giving them a layer of UI to make decisions that have real-world impact. So in a way, they are similar for the ultimate purpose of the UI, but we display a little bit differently, right? Because an interesting thought is whether or not augmented reality is going to kind of bridge this gap a little bit mm-hmm. as well, right? Between gaming world and enterprise world. But what I love about the enterprise world is that it's solving a different set of problems than the gaming world. In the gaming world, you're in a confined space. The rules of the game, the limitations of the game is a confined space for which your UX exists. In the real world, it's unbounded. your use cases are unbounded. It's because it's people interacting with the real world. Your systems are unbounded. It's arbitrarily complex because it's humans interacting with other humans at some point. So the UI in the enterprise world can become a lot more complicated. And I feel like if I say enterprise applications and your mind immediately goes to Excel sheets and Microsoft Access
tables,
forms,
yeah.
then that is because many companies, many businesses have taken the shortcut and said, okay, this is a good enough way to visualize our information and we're going to stop here. And I think there's definitely room for disruption, especially with our young UX designers today, dreaming up new ways for people to interact with their data.
Yeah, you're touching a very good point about, I guess, the challenges of creating products in the enterprise, like especially like, B2B internal tools kind of products, right? When companies, at least from what I've seen so far over the course of my career, the priority to make it visually appealing and more usable and more delightful as an interface, as an experience, for internal tools is always, at least has been always, like almost below the line on the priorities. So it's functional, yes, because it just kind of allows you like the tasks that you have to complete or you want to your users to complete. But it stops there because there's like so many other priorities that kind of more important than just making that particular product or feature shine and like really delight, right, the user. So it's kind of delight is rarely the top of the priorities for enterprise software. And I wonder if you, how do I phrase the question? I wonder if you, from your experience working in enterprise, how do you really, as an engineer, maybe you have found ways how you can influence the people who make decisions about maybe adding this new feature or like this animation or this additional kind of part of the journey for the user to really almost like elevate the baseline experience bar for enterprise UX, because I've seen it's really challenging, like it's almost like a battle, and usually there are other more important things that the leadership team wants to do. So maybe you have like any hacks or like pro tips how one can influence and really excel at enterprise UX.
I don't have so much a hack, but I'll get to that in a moment. 5 years ago, I read an alarming article. It was an opinion piece that said, the generation after millennials and the generation before Gen X do not know how to use computers. And it is a counterintuitive. It is counterintuitive that these groups of people are computer illiterate, because with the generation after millennials, I'm not really sure what they're called, Gen Z, they are constantly on their smartphones and their computers and laptops. How could they not know how to use computers? And it comes down to, well, expectations have changed. You put someone who's never worked with Excel in front of Excel, do we expect them to know what to do right away? Can they be as productive as an expert user? The answer is no. What our generation, or our post-millennial generation have is a set of UIs that are very similar, and they've been trained in that world to work with social media, to work with all the tools with uploading a picture or a video, right? And it's not as enterprisey, where because our enterprise systems are still kind of stuck in the world of spreadsheets and tables and forms. Exactly. Here is the issue. There is an entire generation of people who don't know how to work effectively with a lot of the tools that our enterprises are depending on. So you hire someone new. The first question is, well, what is their onboarding time? Well, that onboarding time is going to be significantly higher if the tools do not match the user experience expectations. In other words, what are they familiar with? So convincing people to adopt new ways to build the UI is a matter of cost to the business, right? We can demonstrably show with metrics, ideally, that a well-made UI is not just spacing or fonts or colors. It's more about the interaction patterns and the expectation of how something works, right? So again, there is a cost coming where when the millennials retire, someone has to keep the business going. And those people might not think about spreadsheets and tables and forms. And we need them to be able to continue the business, right?
That's true. What are your thoughts, though, on okay, so maybe I'll ask from another angle. So I understand the rationale, and I agree that makes sense. However, I have a feeling, but by the time this problem becomes critical, right, and when like enterprise UX, like as a generalization, does not meet the expectations or the bar of the expectations of the next generation, like Gen Z, right, who are more, I guess, who have been trained to use almost like social media created bubble of UX patterns and like the even like yeah the interactions, like as you said, like uploading photos or like sharing, resharing the posting, liking, right? So it's almost like there's like a niche industry of the interfaces that's related to these particular tasks and maybe even like sub industry within all the tech, right? Which is kind of social media. I wonder if by that time, when it becomes that critical, the technology, especially with like AI developments, will be at that level of competency that it will be able to convert all the complex UIs and like even the mental models around how you would display so much data on a screen into something that's easier to digest for a person who is not used to data-heavy interfaces, right? So, because especially, and this kind of leads into the next question on the agenda, especially as a front-end engineer, I've heard some folks are like, and it's similar to UX world, so there's like almost advocates and skeptics, about how their job will change because of the how fast the AI and those interfaces have been evolving, right? So maybe what I'm trying to hear your opinion on is, what do you think will change with the front end as a profession, front end engineering as a development as a profession? How the new AI tools will be helping engineers in the future, or maybe will be taking their jobs. I don't know. You tell me. And kind of the previous, like the initial question that I asked, like what if by the time that this enterprise UX bar would become more critical to the productivity and like onboarding time and additional costs of newer generation coming in, what if actually AI would all, like solve this problem and this wouldn't be a problem at all?
Oh, I so wish, I wish that AI will get there. I cannot wait for AI to get to the point where I can go to an AI and think of it not as a tool, but as a buddy. And I think a lot of the AI advancements in the last year, right? Last year, 2022, was the year of the generative model. The generative model, there are three big ones that comes to mind. One is, of course, ChatGPT, general generative model for text. There is Stable Diffusion, a generative model for visual arts. And there was GitHub Copilot, which is a more specific version of a large language model specifically for writing code. So I've had the opportunity to play with all three of them.
Yeah, this is my question. Like, have you tried it?
Yeah. So I've had an opportunity to try all of them. And it's definitely different, right? It's different interacting with them. I am amazed by their results. Now, here's something that's really...
In a good way or not so good way?
In a really good way. A really good way. I can see how these tools can help, but I can also see how they're not going to replace yet. And I think what's happening is these tools came to being, right? They weren't created to solve a problem. These kind of were created out of curiosity. It's like, can we do it? Yes. Okay, now we have a tool. So now society as a whole is kind of learning, how do we use them? And to be quite honest, they're kind of clunky, right? So I'll start with the first one, Stable Diffusion. Stable Diffusion, you can provide it a prompt and it will generate an image. Now, this one is very easy for most of us to understand because you see an image and you can imagine and go like, oh yeah, that's a puppy, that's a kitten, right? That's a tree or waterfall or whatever. And Stable Diffusion can generate images in different styles, in different qualities or different details. But because it's visual and a lot of us have been seeing things for a long, long time, we're really good at judging whether or not a picture is accurate or if a picture is good. And what we've learned is that Stable Diffusion, while it can generate these pictures really well, a lot of the times they're inaccurate. You know, an extra limb, weird physics, the shading is wrong, or the texture doesn't... Too many teeth. Yeah, there are details that it does not, simply does not get
right. Doesn't understand, yeah.
Exactly. And the question is, well, can we just pump it with more data? Can we do, you know, ChatGPT has 175 billion parameters. If we had an image generation, if Stable Diffusion were a similar generative model had 175 billion parameters for images, would it get better? And the question is, maybe? So far, we don't know. Maybe somebody working at OpenAI or at another bleeding edge tech company might know that. What does the curve look like, right? For an extra parameter, what is the differential between adding one more parameter and the accuracy of the results? But anyways, today it's really, really good, but it's not good enough. I estimate, based off my own experiments with Stable Diffusion, that about 1 in 20 images is accidentally good enough. And maybe that's all we need, but we still needed someone, i.e. me, to judge all 20 pictures and figure out which one is good enough.
I would actually, a quick question there. So I would actually question if we do need an expert like you, because you're like a highly a professional with a lot of expertise in a field, or this can be done by like all this kind of outsourcing kind of platforms, like when all just kind of it's a basic understanding of the image, if it's correct or not correct, to almost like the data quality check by a human on like a data set. I think that's how the learning systems work today, right? So there is like still a lot of humans involved that can do just kind of basic task if it's yes or like if it's good or not enough. So but I mean like Yeah, okay, keep going.
No, that is a really interesting thought. I'm not an art critic. I can tell if something's a kitten or if it has the right number of legs, but I am by no means an art critic. I can't figure out if this is a Studio Ghibli kitten or a Disney Pixar kitten. I can kind of figure it out because, you know, there are certain color palettes, but I'm not an art critic. I wouldn't be able to tell a lot of the edge cases. But you know what I am good at? I'm good at reading code. I'm good at solving code problems. I'm going to talk about GitHub Copilot next, right? GitHub Copilot has been lauded as a way for people to replace coders. At least that's what my parents thought, that I'm going to be out of a job soon because Copilot can just write code for me.
Mm.
So I've had the chance to use it as well. Now, I've been writing code for a long time, so I can judge good code from bad code, and even, you know, whether or not an algorithm will solve a problem. Are there edge cases that it's not covering? And I can say for certain that so far I'm not terribly impressed with the results of Copilot for the purposes of generating net new code. What does that mean? That means I have a problem statement. I write down my problem statement and I ask Copilot to give me the solution. Maybe that's writing a function or an algorithm. Certainly, sometimes it gets parts of it correct, but it rarely gets all of it correct. And this is not just Copilot, it's also ChatGPT. When we give these generative models a question, we need to remember that these generative models cannot reason. It can parse, it can produce relationships, and it can look up solutions, but it cannot reason. So what it ends up producing is commonly created code that responded to a prompt, or at least a similar prompt, which means it's good enough for some base cases, but does not expand to the nuances of the problem statement. This is actually scary, right? If there was a junior developer or a new grad or even someone in university writing code and they decided to use Copilot, they might not be trained well enough to understand when an algorithm is just incorrect in some places. And they might get frustrated that their code simply does not compile because there's a typo in there that Copilot was unable to account for, right? So there are these little problems that kind of compound, and in the compound process ends up producing a result which is not actually solving the problem. What is Copilot really good for? Is for all the things that I cannot fit in my brain. And this comes to Copilot, ChatGPT, and Stable Diffusion, is that they're really good at giving specific examples based off of knowledge that I cannot be bothered to look up. And a very specific example is Copilot was able to help me use a very specific library that's commonly used, but I've never used it. And it was able to help me get started with writing some code using that library. Now, typically what would happen is I'd open up that library's documentation on a separate screen, and every time I need to do something, I will look up how to use that function, what are the parameters, what it's supposed to do, use which cases to use it in, and which cases to not use it in. It's a lot of information to compress, to comprehend and to make use of. And Copilot can make use of it immediately and give me examples. Here's an example of how to use this function properly. That is extremely useful, right? That saves about 10 minutes of reading and understanding. Maybe it's not accurate. I hope it is accurate.
That's a separate question.
That's a separate question, exactly. But so far, it has been great for giving me a jump start on something that is unfamiliar to me, but otherwise well used and well documented. ChatGPT does the same thing with a summarization, right? You can give it a giant documentation and it can give it to you in pieces, and you can tell the prompt to, you know, it's very eloquent, by the way. ChatGPT is super eloquent, and it can spit out pieces of information worded in such a way that it's more easy to digest. So it has been helpful for understanding, but again, I do not trust its accuracy. So once I've learned a certain concept, I'm going to ask it to generate it again in a different word. I'm going to read it again. But in effect, what happens is I take this giant complex piece of text that went way over my head, and I ask ChatGPT, okay, make it simple for me. And then make it simple for me another way, and simple for me another way. At the end of the day, I may have read something that's 10 times longer than the original piece of text, but I digested it better. So you can see how these generative AI models are really good at helping us learn through very specific examples. And we trust, and I don't trust it to do the work for me, but I trust it to help me learn.
Mm-hmm. Okay, two questions.
Yes.
First, you mentioned that ChatGPT, the current version, uses, or at least the 3.5, uses 175 million?
Billion parameters.
What does it mean, really? What is a parameter in this case?
Yeah. I wish I had, maybe I should ask ChatGPT how to describe parameters to you. But here's my understanding, right? When we look at something, an object, there are different properties of that object that we can immediately pick out. You know, the weight, the shape, the color. Those are parameters which goes into describing something. Now, language is a very complex entity. There are many, many, many different parameters, of which I'm not a linguistic expert. I can probably name 20. And ChatGPT, having analyzed all of Wikipedia plus I don't know how many books and websites in the world, has identified 175 billion parameters. That's a lot of parameters. I don't even know how to, I don't know if it names them or anything, but it will be really interesting to, because it, to the best of my knowledge, it is unsupervised learning. It just kind of looked at the different text and came up with, here is something about this text that can be used to group these texts together. And then somehow it got to 175 billion parameters, and now we can use ChatGPT to ChatGPT is a very good predictor of what the next line should be given a prompt.
Interesting. Yeah, I'm going to test it and ask ChatGPT to explain it to a 5-year-old what exactly this means. I feel like I'm really kind of, not enough machine learning and language systems understanding of, like, really to comprehend what exactly this means. Okay, let's talk a bit more about the main topic of this conversation, which is working with designers and working with UX and product designers in particular. So coming from your own experience, because as a front-end engineer, I see your role as one of the most essential roles, in addition to maybe product managers, that UX folks would be working with. I would love to hear from all the years of you working with designers, what really makes a great UX design partner?
What makes a great UX design partner?
Yeah, so like maybe you have some folks can. I'm not talking about myself, obviously, but maybe some folks from your experience that you can recall that I loved working with this person as a designer, and why? What made that relationship special? And the angle that I want you to think about is from the collaboration point of view. So designers who listen to this episode to this conversation, what they can try to do more or do less to become a better project partner and improve the collaboration with engineering teams?
Well, first of all, Kirill, you were an excellent partner. And a lot of it came down to empathy, right? Empathy and appreciation for the complexities and the nuances that all your partners are working, are, like you said, they have these other priorities, and simply understanding that there are those other competing priorities goes a long way to fostering a positive relationship. So I guess the first thing that makes a UX designer really valuable is the open-mindedness and appreciation for the complexities that is building a new product, right? It's there is so much detail that goes into it. It's not just the UI, it's not just the engineering or just the product vision. It is the combination of all three. So appreciation for the complexity is probably up there among positive traits. Another one is being extremely, so I'm an engineer, right? I love metrics. I love understanding why something works or why it doesn't work. Because if I understand the problem and I understand the parameters of my solution, I can reason about it better. So when I am presented with a solution, my first thought is, show me how this solves the problem. And that isn't to say I don't trust the solution. That's just more like, show me, right? Give me the metrics that we care about and show me how this thing works to fulfill those metrics. And the metrics, we need to get a little bit more specific, right? A lot of times we say the metric is customer satisfaction, but that is a very umbrella, very big and broad and vague metric. What about the customer satisfaction is that we care about in this case? Is this, can we measure understandability? Even that is kind of vague, right? We need to get really specific, like, can you demonstrate that this design solves a problem of the user having to switch context to find additional information before they can choose whether or not to click a button? And this, I know I worded it trying to kind of weird, but this is very common when it comes down to things like confirmation boxes, right? You have a call to action or an error happened. And the question is, well, how does the user know to click X or Y? How does the user understand what just happened? And it's, a lot of this comes down to, you know, having the right copy, having the right animation, and having the right, helping users form the right mental model about how your application works. but you see how it's not super simple. It's not just like an error happened, please refresh. It's like, no, that's, it's good that you told them what happened, an error happens, and that there is a call to action, please refresh. But the user doesn't know why did the error happen. Is it something they did? Is it a problem with their environment? Is it a problem with the product, right? Did they do something unexpected? So we need to be able to, so I think that as a good designer, a good designer would tell me, here is a solution, here's a problem that it solves, and here is why it solves that problem, being very specific with it. Because once you get really specific with it, I can then take it and build it, and I can measure it, and then show people that, yes, this definitively does better with this design than the status quo. where this definitively meets our measurable goals. So, and lastly, UX designers are partners, right? I don't want a UX designer who's just going to give in to every time I say, no, this is not technically feasible, try again, right? I don't want that. I want a designer who's going to say,
computer says no.
Computer says no, right? This is a partnership. It's not a one-way. I've seen this before where the relationship goes two ways, right? In one form, an engineer says, no, you're a UX designer. Thanks for the suggestion, but no, we're not doing it because I own the products and I ain't building this. And in another relationship I've seen is the opposite, where the UX designer says, no, this is how it is, developers. Yeah, I gave you the design, you implement it, and then everyone's happy, right? Those are not partnerships. Those are, I don't know what the right word is. Sorry?
Dictatorships,
sure. Those are dictatorships. And we don't want dictatorships, right? This is a collaborative, because the truth is, your first design may not be the best design. The first implementation of a design might not be the best implementation. It's not your first attempt at building anything is probably wrong, and it's not going to get right until many, many iterations later. And if you burn your bridge on the first iteration, you're not going to get to a 10th iteration. So it comes down to we want empathy, we want metrics, and we want recognition that we need everyone to be on the same page, that this is a partnership, and this is a partnership that's going to go on for a while. So that means if you disagree on something, cool, that's good. Bring it up, talk it out, show why something doesn't work, and make it both ways, which means getting a little bit out of the comfort zones, right? For a front-end engineer, that means understanding a little bit better why a certain UX is better. And for a UX designer, that's like why something is technically infeasible. It's a partnership.
So what are you saying is that developers are adults and reasonable humans, and they would appreciate a conversation and negotiation in some cases to find the best, I guess, the more balanced solution that satisfies both sides of this conversation. Is it true?
Well, I don't know if all developers are adults. Yes, in that is the right spirit. But I want to be very clear that does not imply compromise, right? If something cannot be done because we don't have the data to demonstrate that it is the right thing to do, that's one aspect. If something's not done because we simply do not have time, okay. But it's not compromise. It's not like, oh, well, I gave up building with this fancy design. In return, you don't have to build this, right? It's not a compromise. It has to be data-driven. It has to be sensible with the customers in mind.
That's a good point. And I've heard about, being data-driven in how you try to convince your project partners to make this decision or that decision or develop this feature or interaction or that. It sounds more like a universal advice, because every time there is a conversation about what we can and cannot do, either because of the timing constraints or technology constraints, or maybe like this particular animation will cause us like another 3 weeks of engineering time instead of an alternative, which is also good, but maybe designer haven't really thought about this. Maybe 99% good comparing to the original design, but it will take like 3 days to build it. So it's all about, I think, yeah, it's being adults and having this conversation and analyzing using data ideally and some more tangible real points and insights potentially from like either users or technology, and analyzing those alternative ideas and finding the best, I guess, ROI with ideally perfect and as you initially intended the designs. But from my experience, there is always this iteration that you meet somewhere in the middle or at least somewhere there, because there are just like the roadmap or like other the backlog has hundreds of other things that are maybe deserve more attention or at least deserve the attention more than this is like 1% incremental value from the QI point of view. So I agree, like especially having data would help to convince like very practically thinking engineering partners. But sometimes actually data is really hard to get, or it may take more time to get. So I wonder if there was any maybe examples from your experience when you could find, like, what else can be brought into this conversation if there is no data that you can bring? How can you build trust with engineers, like as a designer, right? Because like sometimes you, like this developer should trust you. I mean, always should trust you in UX related stuff. But how can you really increase that trust between two roles?
Yeah, trust. That's a good question. First of all, I want to say that UX is not an easy field to be in. It is not. There's so much complexity and nuance with UX. But here's some ways to build that trust. One is simply education. I think a lot of there is a misconception, and I admit I was part of it at one point, that UX design and graphic design and anything design is basically drawing doodles on a page, a piece of paper or something.
This is what we secretly do, yes.
And certainly doodling has been a very, very valuable part of the process. But it's not the only thing there, right? So I have learned to trust over the years that UX is a disciplined process, that there is a method to it. And that means part of it is establishing industry best practices. Now, if there's a decision that I don't agree with, but you can tell me, well, it is industry best practices, then therefore we're not going to do a separate UX research to prove it, then I'm okay with that, right? I think that it's perfectly reasonable to not repeat research because we don't have the time and resources to verify that a button must be at minimum 44 by 44 pixels for accessibility reasons. So I think that partly it's knowing the industry best practices and being able to confidently cite it, in a way. I don't mean citation as you write me a paper and cite it. I just mean like point me to your source. Just point me to your source. I can read. And certainly that's going to be half your battle, right? But the other half is, well, when someone presents me with an idea and it runs counterintuitive to something I'm thinking about, really, I just want you to understand, well, why is it A and not B? And of course, we do something called A-B testing. If it is small enough to implement both, right, and we can then you actually find the data that we could not, that we did not have before. And a lot of times, A-B testing shows us indefinitive results. Meaning we can't really be sure because the sample size was not big enough, or the answers not really, or we had bad metrics, or the responses were too evenly spread out. Then we just know it doesn't really matter then. but usually it comes down to sample size or poor metrics. Well, another point for why understanding your metrics is super important. But what else we can do to earn trust? I'm going to take a hack out of psychology, the mere exposure symptom. So being merely phenomenon says that the more you're exposed to something, the more you're going to trust it. So that means, ping your, reach out to your partners in engineering and products and just be in their world. That innately builds trust through mere exposure. Now, of course, that can also be turned around into an unethical way, but you know, I'm gonna step aside from there for a second, because UX designers have been nothing but the most ethical beings I have worked with so far, and say, you know, it's a partnership. Earning that trust is, the trust almost exists naturally, right? By showing what you have done before, and by being able to speak eloquently about the reasons defending your design decisions. That builds trust so easily that once you've established that trust, then everyone trusts your judgment in the face of not having data. It doesn't give you permission to push designs through without justification, but it can sidestep a lot of the uncertainties around your designs, right? If you say, well, I chose this pattern because it is industry best practice, no one's really going to question you if you earned their judgment, if you've earned the right to practice judgment. And no one is going to really push back if you have a design that's a little bit out there, right? It doesn't fit with any of the existing existing UIs that they've worked on, because they trust that you have your customers' interests at heart.
Yeah, that's amazing advice. And it's almost like, I think I should be doing more of this. And also, it's just like verbalizing why you put this thing here and this thing there when doing this kind of demos and presentations. So really explain the rationale, the thinking behind. Because in most cases with designers, like, the rationale is there. And it's not just kind of like taste, right? It's kind of really you're using either best practices or the common heuristics and the more... like the patterns that are already used outside in the world, that kind of people have learned already and more familiar with and expect. But it's always in the head. Like, it's rare, like, it's not, at least for me, I don't always communicate or articulate why this is, what benefits this option has versus over this, and the pros and cons kind of debate between different variants that we explore. It's almost like an action item for me from this conversation. good tip. Well, yeah, this was like really, really actionable advice for how to build trust. I love it. Okay, so let's close this up. Last question. If money wasn't a problem and you didn't have to worry about this, what would you do?
In a world where I am free to take risks, financial risks, without fear, I would be very interested in building a space for people to explore human-computer interactions freely, right? So if you think about Oculus created the virtual reality headset. It's not just a headset, though. They also experimented with the Bluetooth tracking, right? That's the form of human-computer interaction. And it's amazing because the interactions are just so fluid now, so natural. And now they're doing things with, can we get rid of the controller? Can the headset not just see your hands and figure out what it is you're doing? I think that's amazing, right? And I want to take that, but expand it. And I know all throughout the world, there's all these different companies doing things like tactile modular components that attach together to form user interfaces in the real world. And if I was free of financial burdens, I would love to create a space for UX designers and engineers and product people to come together and just build these amazing, innovative ways to interact with computers. Because let's face it, the mouse and keyboard is old. And we need more disruptions in this space because there are people with accessibility needs. There are people who need to be able to work with these amazing tools, but do not fit the mold of a neurotypical able-bodied person. And that's super important that we have feedback, not just in the form of screen and sounds, but haptic feedback, motorized feedback, all sorts of ways to interact. Because I think that will take us to the next generation of how humans and computers, well, how humans use computers. And I think that's where I want to go.
So it sounds like it's almost like an innovation lab of sorts, because it's not just about digital interfaces that you're talking about. It's also been a physical, almost like alternatives to exploring all the other possible channels of communicating between humans and computers, right? Like the interfaces.
Yes.
Very interesting. Yeah. So probably like something along the lines of VR and AR companies would be a more aligned place to work at, or at least kind of the directions of you would be building.
Potentially VR, AR, robotics, and of course AI. It all comes together, right? It all comes together.
Interesting. Awesome. That's interesting. Okay. If somebody wants to reach out and ask a few questions or continue the conversation, where can they find you?
Best way to reach me is by LinkedIn. Karel, if you could share my LinkedIn link. Perfect.
Awesome. Thanks, Dechen. This was very interesting. Frankly, I haven't covered all the questions I had for you due to time constraints, but it was super insightful, very valuable, and even for myself, I got some action items to focus on as a designer in the work setting, at least.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me today, Karel.